Today is Monday, July 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump used weekend speeches to set the agenda of his presidential campaign.
We will expose this dangerous movement, protect our nation's children, end this radical assault, and preserve our beloved American way of life.
Plus, do recent court martials in Myanmar go far enough to address wrongdoing?
It doesn't quite make sense when you first look at it.
And the world says goodbye to a legendary composer. We'll have those stories and more next. U.S. President Donald Trump spent the 4th of July weekend at Independence Day celebrations in South Dakota and Washington. He used both events to deliver a strong message on law and order, the platform that his campaign is focusing on ahead of the November election. White House correspondent Patsy Wiedekoswar traveled with Trump to South Dakota and starts us off.
A celebration of America's independence above Mount Rushmore, in front of a crowd of thousands, most not wearing masks. President Donald Trump delivered a dark and somber speech presenting a re-election campaign platform focused on law and order to rally his supporters against what he calls the new far-left fascism.
We will expose this dangerous movement, protect our nation's children, end this radical assault, and preserve our beloved American way of life.
Trump's visit to this giant monument of past American presidents came after months of Black Lives Matter protests, and as his administration clamped down on protesters who want to remove statues of figures who supported slavery and white supremacy. He delivered a strong rebuke of what he called the cancel culture against the country's heritage.
This monument will never be desecrated. These heroes will never be defaced. Their legacy will never, ever be destroyed. Their achievements will never be forgotten. And Mount Rushmore will stand forever as an eternal tribute to our forefathers and to our freedom.
Vanessa Beasley teaches presidential rhetoric at Vanderbilt University.
Basically trying to say to his base audience, hey, if you don't like what's happening with all these monuments, I'm going to go to the biggest and most immovable monument there is, and I'm going to claim it as my own.
In a speech that some have called divisive, Trump portrayed the left as an angry mob that incites chaos and steers the country towards totalitarianism.
We will not be tyrannized, we will not be demeaned, and we will not be intimidated by bad evil people.
The us versus them speech came as Trump trails in political surveys, further behind his Democratic campaign rival, former Vice President Joe Biden. Nationally, in key battleground states, and even in traditionally conservative strongholds like Missouri and Texas. Michael Cornfield teaches politics at George Washington University.
Right now, his campaign is a dumpster fire. And I say that not just because of the polls, but because there are Republicans who are vocally opposed to him.
A National Pew Research poll shows Trump 10 percentage points behind Biden. In 2016, Trump managed to beat Hillary Clinton despite her lead in the polls. Robert Griffin is research director of the Democracy Fund Voter Study Group.
There's still a lot of time between now and the election, and 2020, if anything, has shown itself to be a rather tumultuous year. But at present, the president certainly, I think, has a lot to worry about. And it looks like an uphill climb for him.
As new coronavirus cases surpass 50,000 daily, and despite health officials urging Americans to scale back 4th of July celebrations this year, Trump also held a Salute to America event at the White House. Patsy Wiedekoswara, VOA News.
Both Democrats and Republicans in Congress are expressing outrage over reports that a Russian military intelligence unit paid bounties to Taliban forces to target American forces in Afghanistan. The U.S. Department of Defense continues to evaluate that intelligence information, and the White House and the intelligence community are engaged in a debate about when or even whether President Trump was briefed about this matter. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy discussed what would have prompted Russia to offer the bounties with Mark Katz, professor of government and politics at George Mason University.
I think that there's a number of possible answers. Certainly, people have cited the February 2018 firefight in Syria between U.S. forces and Wagner, private military corporation, Russian-run operation in which the Russians really got beaten, and that some see this as sort of a retaliation for that. But I just saw a story in the Daily Beast indicating that these Russian payments to the Taliban may have begun some years earlier. Another possible is that they see Russian support for the Taliban as no different from American support for the Mujahideen in the 1980s. So what is the issue? But still, the question is, why would they do this? It strikes me that one can even here have two different answers. One is because the Russians really want the Americans out of Afghanistan, as do the Taliban, and that what the Russians really don't want to see is the American-led peace process succeed. They don't want to see another peace process like the Camp David Accords, in which the U.S. influence remains. What they want is for the U.S. out altogether, and then possibly a Russian-led peace agreement or no peace agreement, but that the U.S. have less influence. So that's one possibility. Another is that they don't want the U.S. to leave, because you know, the U.S. presence in Afghanistan has helped protect Russian interests in Central Asia, that if the U.S. wasn't there and the Taliban had decided to support their allies in Central Asia, as they did in the late 1990s, then Russia would have to be the one who dealt with this. Whereas if the Americans are there, they can more or less do the work for the Russians. So, you know, I think there's a variety of possible reasons for why the Russians are doing this.
What should the U.S. do before it formulates an informed policy response?
Well, I think that an important thing to do is sort of to understand, what is it that Russia wants in Afghanistan in particular? And I have a feeling that it's probably revenge is part of it, but that what we don't want to do is to respond in a way that drives the Russians and the Taliban closer together. The problem for the U.S. have a lot of adversaries, and sometimes when we move against our smaller adversaries, all we succeed in doing is driving them into the arms of our larger ones.
Mark Katz is a professor of government and politics at George Mason University near Washington. He was speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Elshenawy. As the global tally from the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases approaches 11.5 million, India reported more than 23,000 new patients Monday, pushing its total during the pandemic past Russia to rank third in the world. While governments in many countries grapple with how to respond to the coronavirus, a group of 239 scientists from 32 different countries are calling on the World Health Organization to update guidance concerning the prospect of airborne spread of the virus. The scientists say there is evidence the virus can linger in the air and that smaller particles can infect people. The WHO also said on Saturday that it was discontinuing its trials of the malaria drug hydroxychloroquine and the combination of HIV drug lopinavir and ritonavir in hospitalized patients with COVID-19 because they did not reduce deaths. And ahead of the start of the Hajj pilgrimage, which typically draws 2.5 million Muslims in Saudi Arabia, the government said it will limit the number of pilgrims to 1,000. Muslims from outside Saudi Arabia will not be allowed this year, and according to new rules announced on Monday, pilgrims will not be allowed to touch the Kaaba and will have to maintain a physical distance of at least 1.5 meters while performing rituals and prayers. VOA has expanded global coverage of the pandemic on our website. And still to come,
it doesn't quite make sense when you first look at it. You say, okay, well, geez, they did try three people, but there's no information about who was tried, what the charges were, who the witnesses were, what these people are alleged to have done.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have confirmed over 4,000 worlds beyond our own solar system. In recent years, astronomers have been able to learn more about specific aspects of exoplanets, such as the makeup of their atmospheres, whether they contain liquid water, and other components that could support life. A group of astronomers recently used observational data from the Hubble Space Telescope and the Magellan II Telescope in Chile to analyze WASP-79b. The planet is described as a super-hot Jupiter-sized sun-sized gas giant planet located about 780 light years away from us. The astronomers say they were able to determine WASP-79b is covered with scattered clouds of manganese sulfide or silicate in its yellow skies, that it rains iron, is incredibly humid, and has an atmospheric temperature of about 1650 degrees Celsius. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The Hong Kong Education Bureau said schools should not provide reading material that violates a new national security law unless they use it to positively teach students about the issue. And Article 38 of the national security law states that China can hold individuals accountable for violating it, regardless of their residency status in Hong Kong or wherever they are in the world. China's British ambassador told reporters in a virtual meeting on Monday that that provision isn't anything out of the ordinary, and other nations have similar laws in place. Olivia Enos is a senior policy analyst for Asia with the Heritage Foundation in Washington. She disagreed.
I mean, this is a typical play out of Beijing's playbook. They are constantly trying to make the laws of China extend to Chinese citizens abroad, and also beyond that. I know there's concern that it would apply to, you know, foreign nationals that are in Hong Kong or even speak out against Hong Kong. I think we saw that the new law may have implications for people who shoot off something in favor of Hong Kong protesters or democracy or freedom there, just from their Twitter anywhere, that if they were to travel to Hong Kong, they could potentially be held on charges under the new national security law. This is a broad sweeping effect, and I think that this is where the international community needs to be really, really vigilant in safeguarding its own sovereignty of whatever country China is kind of trying to make it extend to. So this is definitely pernicious, very worrisome. And I think, you know, as I've heard a lot of people saying, self-censorship is the most dangerous form of censorship because you can't measure to what extent it's being done and the effect that it has on the individual. And I think laws that try to extend beyond Beijing's own borders certainly have that type of chilling effect. And we from the free world need to communicate that that's completely unacceptable.
So speaking of something that is unacceptable to, you know, the free world, as you put it, what kind of response can other nations have?
Well, the U.S. has already taken steps. Secretary Pompeo decertified Hong Kong's special status that grants it, you know, unique treatment under U.S. law vis-a-vis China. And that was a significant step. It was one that was required by the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act. But there's a lot of latitude and leverage that the U.S. does still have, both from an economic standpoint and from a political standpoint. I think it remains to be seen which aspects of U.S. policy toward Hong Kong will change and how swiftly those changes will take root. But any sort of changes that are considered should be for the purposes of changing the risk calculus of Beijing, of upping the ante so that Beijing doesn't continue to erode freedom in Hong Kong, and so that they know that there are consequences to introducing legislation like the national security law. I think also there are great ways to support the Hong Kong people by looking at various avenues for offering refugee status, like folks in the UK have done, like folks in Taiwan have done, and like folks in Congress are currently considering here in the US. But I think, you know, unfortunately, what's done is done. The die was cast when the national security law was introduced. And I think that's when everybody ominously recognized that one country, two systems was meeting its premature end. But hopefully we can take steps that help to punish Beijing while also helping to safeguard whatever is left, the vestiges of freedom for the Hong Kong people.
Olivia Enos is a senior policy analyst for Asia with the Heritage Foundation. The top American diplomat in Hong Kong says it is a tragedy to use the semi-autonomous Chinese territory's new national security law to chip away at fundamental freedoms in the Asian financial hub and create an atmosphere of coercion and self-censorship. The U.S. Consul General to Hong Kong and Macau says Hong Kong's success has been because of its openness and that the United States will do everything it can to maintain that. China said it will decide its response to Britain's offer to offer citizenship to British National Overseas or BNO passport holders in Hong Kong once it has seen the details of a plan recently announced. China's ambassador to London accused Britain on Monday of gross interference and of making irresponsible remarks. The prosecution's closing arguments will be heard on Monday in the trial of a 93-year-old former Nazi concentration camp guard for complicity in the murder of more than 5,000 people during World War II. In what could be one of the last such cases of surviving Nazi guards, Bruno Day stands accused of complicity in the murder of 5,230 people when he was working at the Stutthof camp near what was then Danzig and now Gdansk, Poland. Day, who has appeared in court in a wheelchair, denies bearing any guilt for what happened at the camp. Israel's defense ministry has announced the successful launch of a new spy satellite, giving the country an additional tool in keeping tabs on threats against it from across the region. The launch comes as Iranian officials hinted that Israel was behind a fire that damaged an Iranian nuclear site last week. The OFEC-16 joins a fleet of Israeli spy satellites that have been launched over the past two decades. Officials did not identify specific threats, but Iran, which Israel accuses of trying to develop nuclear weapons, is first among them. Defense Minister Benny Gantz called the launch an extraordinary achievement. On June 30th, three Myanmar military officers were found guilty by a court-martial investigating atrocities against Rohingya Muslims in the conflict-ridden Rakhine State. Human Rights Watch calls the convictions an ongoing effort by the government to evade meaningful accountability. I asked Human Rights Watch Deputy Director for Asia, Phil Robertson, via Skype in Khon Kaen, Thailand, to explain.
The reason that we, you know, I mean, it doesn't quite make sense when you first look at it. You say, okay, well, geez, they did try three people. But there's no information about who was tried, what the charges were, who the witnesses were, what these people are alleged to have done. The massacre we're talking about here is one of the worst that occurred during the crimes against humanity and ethnic cleansing that took place during the Burmese military's clearance operations against the Rohingya in 2017. And to, you know, have three unspecified soldiers court-martialed, we don't even know if they were sentenced to anything. What you have is really an effort by the Myanmar military to say, hey, look, see, we held some people responsible. But really, these are scapegoats. These are low-level people. And even with those cases, there's no transparency about what actually happens. There was a previous case that Reuters reported on. This was the famous Indian case where a number of soldiers killed 10 Rohingya prisoners. Mm-hmm. And those people were court-martialed in a similar procedure behind closed doors, no information. And they were later pardoned 7 months later by the army commander. And it took several months for everybody to figure out that actually they had been let out of prison. Those people who were involved in killing those 10 men actually spent less time in prison than the two Reuters journalists who reported on the story and were framed for an Official Secrets Act arrest.
So what needs to happen in terms of holding individuals accountable, in your opinion?
Well, the Burmese military has shown time and time again that it is incapable of investigating itself. It has no real political commitment to do so. And what we get time and time again is a whitewash, even in cases where they do say they court-martial people. There needs to be some sort of independent and impartial investigation that is allowed access to these areas to conduct a full investigation and assess accountability and hold people accountable. The problem is that the Myanmar government will not allow anybody into these areas. The UN Special Rapporteur, the previous one, Yang He Lee, was not able to even enter the country. And the fact-finding mission that was established by the United Nations to look into these things, of course, was also denied access to the country. There's no real political commitment from the Myanmar side to hold anybody accountable. They want these horrible massacres, which some people claim constitute genocide, to largely be crimes where no one is ever brought to book.
Phil Robertson is the Human Rights Watch Deputy Director for Asia. Myanmar currently faces charges of genocide at the United Nations top court over the 2017 crackdown against the Rohingya. Some 750,000 Rohingya fled to neighboring Bangladesh with accounts of widespread murder, rape, and arson. And finally, Italian composer Ennio Morricone died in a Roman clinic Monday morning, where he was being treated for a fractured femur due to a fall. He was 91 years old. A musician, composer, and conductor, Morricone was well known as the author of some of the most famous and beautiful soundtracks of Italian and world cinema. He composed the music for more than 400 films, including Sergio Leone's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly in 1966, and Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight, for which he won an Oscar for in 2016. And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In Asia, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, has worked for decades to build successful partnerships with countries to ensure that they expand their self-reliance. It does so by promoting and strengthening democratic systems and values, fostering inclusive, private sector-led economic growth, and improving natural resource management. Encouraging self-reliance must be key to any development decision, said Gloria Steele, USAID Senior Deputy Assistant Administrator of the Bureau for Asia.
The work that we have done has shown that for development to be sustained, the country needs to be self-reliant. A country needs to be able to eventually take over and plan and finance their own development.
One challenge to economic growth and self-reliance in Asia today is rising authoritarianism, which weakens democratic institutions and fuels non-transparency and corruption. Another related challenge, Ms. Steele declared, is China's problematic engagement in the region, including its predatory economic activities.
We enter into a strategic partnership where what is good for the country comes first. China's approach is almost exactly the opposite. There is no transparency.
The secretive nature of China's dealings means that civil society is kept in the dark about the terms of the loans China is offering, opening the door to corruption. There is no way to keep officials accountable for investing their country's resources sustainably. According to the Center for Global Development, 6 of the 8 most highly debt-distressed countries are in Asia. Part of the difficulty many face is their partnership with China, in particular through the One Belt and One Road initiative, which includes debt-financed projects in transportation, energy, and infrastructure. China offers countries opaque loans for projects of questionable value that also harm local communities, leaving countries on the hook if the projects fail and they cannot pay them back. Senior Deputy Assistant Administrator Steele describes the consequence.
When another country owns most of what belongs to you, that significantly affects your sovereignty.
Through USAID, the United States works to empower its partners to move them closer to self-reliance and independence. China's approach leads nations into dependence and debt. While the United States' vision for assisting countries in Asia and elsewhere excludes no nation, every nation that seeks to help others should adhere to high standards, including sustainable financing and respect for their partners' autonomy and sovereignty.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.